It's no secret that the economies of Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan rely heavily on labor migration to stay afloat. In 2022, according to the International Organization for Migration, remittances from Russia accounted for just over half of Tajikistan's GDP and made up more than 20% of the GDPs of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. Many of the workers sending these remittances are their family's sole breadwinner, and given the lack of employment opportunities at home, working in Russia is often their best or perhaps their only option, even if it means dealing with a maze of bureaucracy and relentless discrimination. The aftermath of last month's terrorist attack in Moscow has brought the xenophobia that Central Asian migrants face in Russia back into the spotlight, with media outlets reporting on a surge in blatant discrimination and, in some cases, targeted violence. The Russian authorities also launched a renewed crackdown on migrant workers. Veteran human rights lawyer Valentina Chupik told journalists she received more than 2,500 calls from migrants about incidents such as illegal detentions, police raids, and acts of aggression in the first 2 days after the attack alone. But the migrant-host country relationship works both ways. Russia, with its shrinking population and labor shortage made worse by the war, needs migrant workers to keep its economy functioning. So what does it mean when the Russian authorities make a show of deporting migrant workers, denying them entry at the border, and making inflammatory but implausible claims about rising crime rates among migrants that contradict official records? Is cracking down on labor migration actually an effective way to combat terrorism? And why is Putin still pushing the idea that Russia is a land of multi-ethnic and interfaith harmony? We tackle all these questions and more on this week's show. Welcome to The Naked Pravda.
Hello, and welcome back to The Naked Pravda. I'm Eilish Hart, the editor of Medusa and English's long reads newsletter, The Beat. I'll be one of your hosts for this week, along with our senior news editor, Sam Brazil, who you heard at the top of the show. In this episode, we're following up on the fallout from the Crocus City Hall attack and taking a deep dive into Russia's migration policy under Putin. Our first guest, Leyla Latipova, is a special correspondent with the Moscow Times, covering politics and society in Russia's ethnic republics. In your reporting for the Moscow Times, you interviewed Central Asian migrants in the aftermath of the Crocus City Hall attack, and the people you spoke to seemed to feel as though things were taking a turn for the worse. So I wanted to start by asking you if they were primarily fearful of the official response to the attack, so reports of increased police raids, tougher restrictions on migrants and migration, and so on, or were they mainly fearful of retaliation from ordinary Russians, such as we've seen in reports about more isolated xenophobic attacks?
When I spoke to the migrants, the primary concern is xenophobia coming from the Russian populace as a whole. Yet what statistically we see and the reports we see coming out of Russia, the real concern is actually coming from the government. You know, it's the mass police raids, it's mass deportations. And that's what human rights lawyers in Russia who work particularly with migrant groups, that's what they're concerned about. And when you ask them statistically what kind of requests they receive, it's mostly all about police violence, illegal detentions, illegal deportations, etc. And the actual number of reported, and I will highlight that it's reported xenophobic attacks, we actually don't know. Maybe people just don't approach lawyers when they face violence. Routine violence, unfortunately, that's what we can call it. Human rights lawyers say that the number of requests they receive about xenophobic attacks, they're minimal. So it is a very interesting discrepancy between what is actually happening and the perception of what people are scared of. Because for many migrants, they say, no, my papers are in order, therefore I'm not scared. You know, if there will be a raid, what can they do? Yet, as we know, the Russian law enforcement system always can find a pretext to arrest you. And again, they have been just thousands probably of people deported already from Russia. And a lot of those deportations have been illegal because they indeed had their papers in order. So yeah, there is this fear of xenophobia, but the real threat is again coming from the Russian government.
Is there much that human rights activists can do to help migrants in these situations, or are they more so just recording what's happening?
Yeah, I think at this point, it's just a matter of recording it. I know some cases they can take to court. I don't know the exact statistics right now, how many successes they had in kind of arguing against the decisions of Russian authorities. But of course, when it comes to illegal deportations, oftentimes that's irreversible. The person has already left Russia, that's it. And they probably have official paper trial that will prohibit them from entering the country in the future. So it's just as we see with political repressions, it's very similar kind of way of thinking. It's impossible in many cases to argue against the decisions of Russian authorities. It would be interesting, of course, to know what's the success rate. But again, it's very difficult to track because it's individual lawyers who work with activists. So we have very kind of skewed statistics. Plus, as I said, you know, before, not many migrants, it seems, that even go to lawyers or have contacts, have a chance to stand up for their rights. But also, I think an important part of it is that Russia is becoming a less and less attractive destination for migrant workers. So perhaps a lot of them just feeling that pressure, they choose to look for other avenues to make money and other destinations to go and work where it would be easier and safer all around. Because when I say that xenophobia is not as blatant, we have to kind of highlight what we're judging against, because Russia is incredibly racist and xenophobic already. So they might have not been an unusual spike in attacks, but we're judging against already an incredibly large number of attacks on migrant workers and just daily harassment, but also blatant refusal to employ them, even when they have all the rights to be employed, etc. and etc.
How has this latest wave of xenophobia affected other ethnic and religious minorities in Russia, like indigenous people?
When I spoke to one of the migrant workers, in fact, a taxi driver in Moscow, he just said this brilliant phrase, "We all have the same face to them," meaning to Russians, we all look the same. He referred, of course, that Russians cannot differentiate between migrants from Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan, but same goes to Russia's indigenous people. There is this kind of tag phrase, люди восточной внешности, the people with the Eastern looks. And that's basically 30% of Russia's population, people who were born in that country. So that means it's people from the Caucasus, from the Urals, from Siberia, meaning the native population. So they all look foreign and Eastern and non-Slavic. So, of course, xenophobia in this sense does not differentiate between your passport or where you were born. And when we speak of xenophobic attacks, this worsening trend happened before Krokus City Hall. I spoke to Alexander Verkhovsky from Savat Center, which tracks xenophobic attacks in Russia. They've done it for decades. And he actually noted that their research shows that this sudden kind of upward trend in the number of attacks, it dates back to last year. And suddenly, it's actually a resurgence of skinhead groups. Those were very big in the early 2000s in Russia, when violence was perhaps worse than now. And we see that this trend is re-emerging now. So there are open kind of hooligan-like attacks on people who have this quote-unquote Eastern look. So that can be migrants, that can be people indigenous to Russia who maybe even were born in Moscow. You know, there is like no difference. So yeah, in that sense, anyone who is non-Slav, non-Russian, no one is safe anymore. But I mean, that has been Russia's very, very sad reality for many years. Islamophobia is also another huge concern. So when you layer that, and if you wear a hijab or go to a mosque, the risks just increase tenfold. And again, there are just horrific stories of women wearing not even a hijab, but a headscarf, and they get attacked and also harassed openly. Being a minority myself, I think we've been living this reality for so long that now, after the Krokus City Hall attack, it just came into the spotlight, for better or for worse. Maybe it is a good thing that we're finally talking about, you know.
This increase in violence from skinhead groups in the last year that you mentioned, is this just a result of Russia's official rhetoric amid the war, where the authorities aren't usually talking about Muslims, for example, as like enemy number one, but there is this general increase in patriotism, nationalism, whatever you want to call it? Do you think that's the reason for this?
I think there are several kind of reasons to it. I mean, it is expected that a country that is committing genocide elsewhere, that the violence is just normalized in Russia ever since the start of the invasion of Ukraine. It's becoming more normal. We've all seen the success of Slovo Patsana, the viral TV series that depicts the gangs of Kazan in the 90s and just the sheer ultra violence that era was defined by. And I think it was so successful because violence is normal now. And probably that's why we also pay more attention to this racist and xenophobic rhetoric now after Krakow City Hall attack, because suddenly it is okay to write openly racist slurs online. And that's normal. Your government permits you to do that because, yes, Russian officials also are no longer shying away from that in their official rhetoric. But I think it's interesting because the Russian government is also very opportunistic in that. Things are not going well domestically. Right now, we're witnessing horrible floods. The economy is not exactly in a great shape. So creating this image of another enemy, so there are Ukrainians, that is the enemy, but now there is also the enemy within the country that everyone can unite and fight against, which is this Muslims, migrants, and Asians, minorities, you name it. It's just a very typical populist rhetoric, right? We've seen that in other countries, and in Russia, it also works incredibly well. And we have seen that after the Krakow City Hall attack, more and more regions, governors come out with these big statements that we're going to impose additional restrictions on migrants, etc. So that, A, creates this illusion of unity against some common enemy, and B, just gives you political points because it seems like you are proactively doing something and really care about your people and about the economy and you're going to help everyone. So yeah, it is this kind of populist move. And I think it's important to note that that has been used in Russia across the board. Ethnic republics have not been immune to that. And it has been used for years and years. There is also local nationalism, and it also can be fueled, you know, and fostered by this anti-migrant rhetoric.
Earlier this month, Putin said that Russia, quote, can hardly be a target of terrorist attacks by Islamic fundamentalists, because the country sets a unique example of interfaith harmony. That's how he put it. He also puts a lot of emphasis on Russia being a multinational state or a state with multiple nationalities. What do you make of statements like these from Putin, and where does this rhetoric come from?
Yeah, the multi-faith harmony is a particularly hypocritical one, because let's not forget that I believe before Krakow it were the Russia's own Muslim groups, meaning mostly Chechens, who were marginalized because they were dubbed quote-unquote terrorists. But of course, I think it's the Soviet legacy, right? That's what Soviet Union has always preached, the multi-ethnic harmony. Yet when you look at the posters showing the multi-ethnic unity of Soviet peoples, Russians are always in the center, and then there is everyone around them. So it's very much Soviet legacy, saying that we have this friendship of the peoples when actually there is, in fact, systemic discrimination. But this rhetoric works because you can also see it. You can see it among migrant groups. You can also see it among Russia's indigenous people, that a lot of them say, but no, wait, like, you see that the state does a lot for us. They're not openly discriminating. And of course, it's a consequence of colonialism, because people want to blend in and it's easier for them to accept being a part of the Russian world. So a lot of them want to buy into that rhetoric because that would mean that they're the same with the majority and that they won't kind of feel discriminated against. I mean, we see consequences of that, the Russification, loss of minority and indigenous languages, et cetera, et cetera. So this rhetoric works in a way, but also it fits with Russia's geopolitical ambitions. Russia is very ambitious in the Middle East, in the Islamic world. So of course they will present themselves as very tolerant and promoting multi-faith harmony. Of course, in reality, that's not the case. Islam is Russia's second largest religion. There is no official statistics on how many Muslims live in the country, so we can only guess because Russia's census doesn't collect that data, perhaps deliberately. But the estimate is around 20 million people in Russia identify as Muslims. At the same time, the country has an incredible shortage of mosques, for example. Probably a lot of listeners have seen these photos of men in Moscow praying outside of Moscow's chief mosque. And that's not because anyone wants to be outside and pray outside. That's simply because there are not enough mosques to accommodate all the believers. So people are forced to do that. It's the same problem even in Muslim majority regions, where there is not enough money allocated to build mosques and facilities for praying. So Even in very kind of structural ways of how finances are allocated, Muslims are being, in a sense, discriminated against. And then Kremlin, in this attempt to lure in the Muslim population while not resolving real problems that this group faced, Putin in particular, he also created this image that, for example, like hijab and certain ways of Islam are foreign to Russia. And he's repeated that many, many times, that we have our own Islam and it's supposed to be different, which, of course, absolutely not true. It's just a lot of myths that created around Islam and the other, just to, I guess, bury the truth behind that rhetoric. I think the rhetoric completely contradicts the policies because, as we know, Russia's indigenous people and ethnic minorities are no longer permitted to even learn their native languages at schools. So what multi-ethnic and multi-faith harmony can we talk about? Russia also is grappling with effectively a ban on hijabs because Russia's Supreme Court several years ago ruled that it is not unconstitutional to ban hijab in schools, for example, which, as a lot of lawyers would point out, that means that for Muslim girls who do not want to take off their hijab, that violates their right to education. They cannot go to schools if they're religious. Then we know of a lot of instances when women are being refused jobs because they're wearing a hijab. They're being openly said that, no, we don't allow terrorists here. And in general, racial profiling is a thing when you try to be employed in Russia. And then, of course, as I said, there is the whole cultural erosion. There is erosion of languages, which is happening very quietly while Putin is talking about multi-faith and multi-ethnic harmony. He's also signing laws that basically take away very fundamental rights from indigenous people and minorities.
To untangle the contradictions between Russian officials' rhetoric and the country's dependence on migrant labor, we turn to Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Berlin. Regular listeners will remember Timur from a previous Naked Pravda episode about how Russia pressures Central Asian migrants into military service. If you missed that one, you can find the link in the show notes. The last time you were on the show, we talked a lot about what draws Central Asian migrants to Russia and the ways in which Central Asian countries are dependent on this flow of labor migration and remittances. So I wanted to turn this question on its head and ask you to talk a bit about Russia's dependence on migrant labor and how the flow of workers from Central Asia benefits and props up the Russian economy.
That's a very good point to look at migration, because normally everybody's talking about how Central Asian countries depend on Russia through migration, but Russia also depends on Central Asia heavily when we speak about migration. First of all, right now, the demographic situation in Russia is in huge crisis, the crisis that Russia hasn't seen in decades. There were several estimates about how much more people does Russia economy needs to be more or less stable, and researchers saying that it's around 4 or 5 million people that Russia is lacking right now to keep its economy running and afloat. This is a huge number, and this is a number that even Central Asia cannot fully cover. Normally, from Central Asian countries, there will be around 7 million people annually in Russia. The majority of them are seasonal workers, those who work on different projects and go back home when the season is over. But those people whom Russia needs, considering its demographic crisis, would be those who live in Russia for more than 9 months in 1 year, because those people have the biggest chance to actually stay in Russia and further on get Russian passports, start families there, or bring their families with them and get naturalized in Russia. And the war in Ukraine has affected mostly those people who decide to move to Russia for a long period of time, but to a less extent affected those who come for seasonal work. And this is the biggest threat to Russia's demography overall. Even Vladimir Putin always talks about reproductive kind of situation and blames LGBT and feminists for Russia's crisis in demography. However, the real problem is that Russia's economy sucks, and it cannot just attract those people who previously were happy to acquire Russian passports and to live in Russia and to later on become Russian citizens. This is the first problem. Second one, with seasonal workers, the reality is that some of Russia's economic sectors depend on migrant forces, especially when we speak about big cities. They cannot exist without the migration inflow. Moscow and St. Petersburg are dependent in their services on migration forces. If you will have zero migrants in those big cities, you can forget about any services online or offline that you have, whether it's cashiers in supermarkets or taxi drivers or somebody who is providing some sort of low-skilled service in those cities. Second biggest sector where migrants are concentrated is reconstruction. The majority of Russia's new buildings are being built with the Central Asian forces, whether it's huge projects like the Olympics projects or something as routinely observed in cities around Russia, around 80% of those buildings are built by Central Asia. And the third sector that depends on migrants from Central Asia is agriculture. Agriculture in southern territory of Russian Federation will also struggle without migration from Central Asia. So imagine having no migrants at all, the Russian economy will have big problems.
Just this morning, I saw a headline that said, well, Russia should make migration policy that's in Russia's interests. And I was thinking, well, what are Russia's interests?
That's Kares Shenk, an associate professor of political science at Nazarbayev University, who studies the politics of immigration and national identity in Eurasia.
I mean, in Russia's interests, they should have a much more liberalized migration policy that makes it easier for migrants to come and work, because then they'll be well taken care of, right? And isn't that in the interests of everybody that lives in a country? So it's just really funny to think about, how do you define Russians' interests? Does that mean that you only protect those jobs for Russian native workers? Well, in reality, there's just not enough of them to do the types of jobs that would support the type of economy that Russia actually wants.
Very broadly speaking, could you give us kind of an outline of how Russia's migration policy has evolved under Putin? You know, are there high migration periods and low migration periods we can point to?
The policy kind of goes in waves. So you'll have times of kind of tightened policy, and you'll have times of kind of loosened policy. And these kind of go in circles, right? And they're super reactive to things that are happening in the real world. So, the terrorist attack is a prime example of the type of thing that migration policy reacts to. It's certainly not the first time Russia has reacted, you know, in a sort of populist or securitized way towards migrants. So this is actually pretty normal, business as usual kind of tightening. So I think when Putin came to power, I mean, Putin doesn't really care that much about migration policy per se. You find very, very few statements by Putin directly that have anything to do with migration policy, except at really key moments. And also, when Putin talks about migration policy, he is pretty careful. He's careful not to securitize and not to alienate migrants or their governments. So this is actually a pretty interesting aspect of the policy kind of trajectory and the politics surrounding the policy. So usually when we see these tightening moments, we can attribute those to kind of lower level ministers, or we can attribute them to security services or people like this, but usually not directly to Putin. Nevertheless, in the last maybe 15 years, we really see much more deliberate effort to bring migration policy under control, or to systematize it, or to kind of make it more scientific or something like this, just to have a deliberate migration policy that's going to work for a lot of different interests in Russia. And the problem is that there's a lot of different interests in Russia that want different things from migrant workers. So certainly there's people that want migrant workers and they want them however they can get them. They want them cheap. They're happy to take them illegal. And then there's people that want to kind of liberalize the migration system, either for humanitarian reasons or for sort of liberal economic reasons, or simply just to make Russia more open to the world and to have a sort of more international type of migration policy. But that said, I mean, certainly you do see ebbs and flows. So you see times where the migration policy comes under a lot of attention. Hey, we're going to get things under control. We're going to document these people in these ways, and we're going to have them, you know, do these procedures. And then those procedures turn out to be really difficult, right? So 10 years ago or so, they implemented language requirements for migrants. So even if you're coming to work temporarily, you have to pass a language exam. And at first, this was like, oh no, this is really going to make it difficult for migrants to get legal. And that's true. It did make it difficult for migrants to become legal. But it also, after a very short period of time, led to the proliferation of all sorts of informal schemes that helped migrants solve problems, either by buying language certificates, which involved the complicity of universities and government agencies, or that just simply drove migrants into the informal sector. I think what you see in Russia, a sort of law of migration, which is whenever the policies get more strict, what you're doing is really diverting those migrants into the informal sector. You're not decreasing migration. You're just making it more difficult for them to actually have the legal documents that they need. Russia's a test case of this sort of law of migration. So the best solution is to make it just free and easy for migrants to come, right? But nobody wants that because it looks like the government is not protecting citizens from things like terrorism. So it's really, really hard to have a balanced policy that pleases nationalist voices or voices that want to eliminate migration, and also the economic sector that wants free and flexible types of labor that can fit into the labor market easily.
So I know you said that Putin doesn't care, relatively speaking, about migration. But right after the start of the full-scale invasion, you wrote about how Putin was issuing decrees to try to drive refugees from Ukraine into Russia and granting visa-free access to students from India, China, Central Asian countries, and African countries to Russia. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how else Russia has used migration policy for political purposes, maybe to signal things, even if these decrees don't actually have much impact on the ground.
On the one hand, Putin doesn't care about migration. When we're talking about the migrants that are most prevalent in Russia, which is Central Asians. Now, if we're talking about Ukrainian migrants, Putin cares a lot about this because it feeds into one of his pet projects, and this is the Compatriot Project. The Compatriot Project is a sort of repatriation project that brings presumably sort of co-ethnics back to Russia for citizenship. And so this is seen as a solution to the demographic problem. Russia has a huge demographic problem. You know, the working age population especially is just declining, declining, declining. So whatever sources of population Russia can get, they need to pursue those channels. But there's a clear preference for the types of migrants that are seen as the right type of migrants. And Ukrainian migrants are definitely the right type of migrants. And Central Asian migrants, well, they're seen as sort of the wrong type of migrants. But in reality, they're the only type of migrants that are coming in large numbers. And so even they are regularly utilizing these policies of repatriation in order to get Russian citizenship. So yes, when migration coincides with one of Putin's pet projects, he's really happy to utilize it to his benefit, to either bolster a particular policy or highlight a particular policy. I mean, what did Putin say about the terrorists after the terrorist attack? Oh, well, they came from Ukraine, or they had connections to Ukraine, or they were going to Ukraine, or something like this, right? Immediately, he connected this to his pet project. But after the invasion of Ukraine, and we saw this also after the 2014 annexation of Crimea, there was a big effort to try to get Ukrainians to come east. And so there was lots of policy accommodations and state supports to allow easier integration and access to Ukrainian migrants fleeing east. About a month or so after the invasion of Ukraine, I was watching Russian television and there was a human interest story about this girl coming from Ukraine, integrating into a Russian school in maybe Krasnodar or somewhere in the border regions. And it was really interesting how they were framing the whole social support structure and system in Russia as just getting ready to integrate and give psychological support and all sorts of support to these Ukrainian refugees coming east. And I think that is a picture of how Russia wants to project its migration policy, as we absolutely want to do 110% for the right types of migrants. Now, in reality, the policy promises don't always meet realities. And this is a bigger problem of social services in Russia, right? In reality, it is difficult and bureaucratic to actually access those benefits. So there's been a lot of frustration on the part of those Ukrainian refugees because they can't really realize the benefits that the state offered them. This is just kind of a state capacity issue for Russia in general. So, I mean, it's not surprising. But at the same time, like after the cameras are turned off, those refugees just kind of melt into the Russian social system and they really aren't given a lot of protections.
You've also written about the migration extremism fallacy, which is the idea that migration makes a person more susceptible to extremism. And I can imagine this idea may have occurred to people following the Crocus City Hall attack. So what do we know about the relationship between migration and extremism?
It is often the case that people really connect this idea of migration and extremism. But as I've said before, this is a total fallacy, right? Yes, you have migrants that become extremists, but it's not migration itself that causes migrants to become extremists. We heard a lot about Central Asian migrants fighting in Syria. And the thing that they had in common was that they had all been migrants in Russia. And clearly this is the thing that catalyzes them to be extremists. Well, what they don't tell you is that many, many, many other people that didn't radicalize were also migrants in Russia before they went back home or before they got Russian citizenship or all of these sorts of things. So going to Russia does not cause people to radicalize itself, right? There are other factors that we need to look at that contribute to the radicalization of migrants. And in fact, one thing that I think is probably true is that the way that migrants are treated in Russia in a securitized way probably does more to contribute to extremism than anything else. So by treating migrants as a security risk, they actually marginalize migrants and push them into precarious positions where the only options left to them may be connections that they make that might have an extremist sort of element. Now, what does this really look like in practice? So migrants, when they go to Russia, just like migrants everywhere, they're looking for community. They're looking for just normal human contact, right? And oftentimes the places that they can find this is in religious communities. And religious communities in Russia are often also freer than in their home countries, right? So it's easier to be Muslim in Russia than it is to be Muslim in Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. So it's true, I think, that there is sort of a religious revival that migrants can experience when they're in migration. But that's totally different than radicalization. So I think that people get really confused between these two terms. Like if you become more Muslim, then of course that means that you are automatically radicalized. I mean, this is a very American sort of perspective, right? After 9/11, that all Muslims are terrorists. And it's really, really hard to undo that very, very fallacious way of thinking. Nevertheless, I think that when migrants engage in religious communities in Russia, there are kind of the sanctioned formal religious communities, and there are informal communities. One moment to be careful about, though, is just because a religious community is informal, like if the Tajik religious community is informal, does that mean that it's more prone to radicalization? I wouldn't necessarily connect those dots, but they are more prone to being raided, right? Because they're informal. So they're making noise, they're in unsanctioned spaces, there's people coming to these places that are not zoned as mosques, and this creates maybe public disturbances, right? And so this is an easy and visible way to raid migrants, you know, preserve public order and all of these sorts of things. So that can make those communities more of a target of the state. And while this doesn't itself produce radicalization, it can produce alienation. And so I think there is a link between alienation and radicalization in the literature. But I think it's really important to be really clear about what are the mechanisms that allow for alienation to turn into radicalization. And oftentimes those mechanisms rely on radicalizers, right? So people or propagandists or extremist religious leaders that can somehow utilize those spaces and those alienated individuals to kind of recruit them towards some more radicalized ends. The sheer difficulty of that process means that it's not happening very often. It's not happening as often as we think that it is. It's not happening to everybody. Most Tajik labor migrants in Russia are just trying to stay out of the public eye because they don't want scrutiny. They just want people to leave them alone. They just want to earn money so that they can pay for their wedding back in Tajikistan. And they don't want to make trouble. That's probably the more normal picture of migrants in Russia. But the cases that get a lot of attention, that get a lot of press, are certainly the extreme cases of extremism, right? There's a reason why it's called extremism, because it's really not normal.
I think it's very interesting to use the word extremism now when we're in the context of Russia, because so many dissidents, so many opposition politicians have been dubbed extremists. So now, you know, when we talk about real Islamic extremism and terrorism, it sounds a bit absurd, right, to use that word. And, you know, it's particularly interesting in the context of ethnic republics because this extremist label has been used against activists there since early 2000s. It was tried and tested there far before Navalny, for example, was dubbed extremist, right? And it was particularly easy to use that in Muslim majority regions because it was enough to have a Quran at home. And then you would have a search at your house and they would say, oh, no, you probably pray. And that's why you're so politically active. Extremist, let's jail you. And, you know, we see that that's how Russia orchestrates repressions against activists in occupied Crimea. It's all connected to the so-called Islamic extremism. And we've seen that recently in Bashkortostan, where Fail Alsinov, the indigenous activist who was jailed, he was also dubbed extremist for reasons unknown, but probably because he was speaking of indigenous rights and right to self-determination. So when we think of that history, this recent attack actually will help Russian government and Kremlin in a way to just orchestrate more and more repressions. And again, as I said, particularly in Muslim majority regions, and there are a lot of the republics that can be considered quote-unquote problematic, and particularly Tatarstan and Bashkortostan with its kind of pro-independence drive, they are Muslim majority republics. We also know that in Bashkortostan, a lot of people now under arrest for participating in peaceful protests, they are practicing Muslims. So they pray daily. So again, in the official rhetoric, it's very easy to connect and say, you see those Muslims, they're destabilizing the country. That's what they do. It's such a long running story how the Russian state has very carefully used and abused this Islamophobic sentiment that, yeah, Krakow City Hall attack is just a very, unfortunately, a very logical continuation of that. And I'm sure they will use it again and again to just intensify repressions, and particularly against indigenous people and ethnic minorities.
In the weeks since the attack, we've seen reports about another wave of police raids targeting migrants, of mass deportations, of renewed pressure on naturalized citizens to enlist in the military. Do these developments, in combination with a tightening of migration policies, which we've also seen the Russian government move towards, Do these have the potential to make Russia a less popular destination for migrant workers from Central Asia in the long run? Or is it more likely to sort of lead to a short-term drop off? And then when the situation cools down, it's going to be back to business as usual.
I tend to believe that this is a short-term effect of the terror attack. Because right now, first of all, Russian security services have to prove to the Russian society that they're doing something. They also have to prove to their own heads of ministries, to the political elites in Russia, that they are doing something and they're not sitting and waiting for another terror attack to happen. Another thing that we should also understand here is how Russia's migration policy works. There is no one governmental body or institution that deals with migration in Russia. The migration policy is spread across a bunch of different ministries in the government, which can be broadly separated into two groups. The one group will be the economic bloc of the Russian government, who are interested in attracting more migrants inside Russia. And the second part is siloviki, those who deal with Russia's security. And these guys, they don't like migrants. They don't want to see them inside Russia. But later I will tell you that even they need migrants inside Russia. So because of that, Russia's migration policy is always this process of push and pull. One ministry is interested in creating an atmosphere for migrants that will attract them. Another one will create additional barriers for migrants to come. So it always very chaotic and not consistent. But what the terror attack has done right now is it has given the part of Russian government that responsible for security a very strong argument for limiting the amount of migrants inside Russia, for creating additional bureaucratic barriers for them, and broadly making their lives more miserable, which will lead to them staying at home rather than coming to Russia. And because of that, we are seeing that Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs, Rosgvardia, Следственный комитет, Investigative Committee, all those agencies are talking a lot about the need to create new laws for migration, on creating different other documents that migrants should acquire before coming to Russia or before starting to work in Russia. But in the end of the day, they don't create new reality where Russia lives in. They cannot just say that Russia doesn't need migrants and the process of migration will stop. It is out of their control to limit or attract more migrants, because this is a structural dependency on both sides. Russia needs migrants as well as Central Asian countries need to send migrants. And even if the Russian government can create some more additional bureaucratic obstacles for migrants, it will not surprise those migrants that are coming to Russia, because they understand already right now that there are many documents that they need for work. They understand that the process of legalization inside Russia is quite challenging. And there are a lot of lawyers, companies that help to deal with that. And this is not something that was not expected by Central Asian migration community. And because of that, this will not become a huge obstacle. What can limit the amount of migrants that are coming to Russia is the economic situation of Russian Federation. If the Russian national currency is going down, the amount of migrants that want to go to Russia is going down as well. So this is something that works always, but bureaucratic obstacles do not work.
Every time something happens in Russia, experts say this is the time that migration is really going to be affected and migrants are really going to stop going to Russia and they're going to go to Turkey and South Korea and Poland instead. This is the time when it's really going to be the turning point that stops Central Asian migrants from going to Russia. And then we see that that actually doesn't happen. We saw that with the 2008 financial crisis. And then we see it with every kind of policy implementation. And then we saw it, of course, or we predicted that migrants would stop going to Russia or that they would leave Russia as a result of the war because of sanctions or because of sort of moral culpability, right? That migrants would feel like they didn't want to participate in Russia's economy or something like this. But it's never really the magic bullet that we always think that it might be. So, and I predict, if I can predict anything, which I'm kind of anti-prediction, but if I can predict anything, it would be that this is probably going to be more of the same, right? That you'll see a clamp down. So you'll see more raids on migrant spaces like mosques and residential facilities and places where migrants are employed. And you'll see more arrests, you'll see more deportations, more checks on the streets, tightening of policy, all of these sorts of things. And you'll see that for, you know, a couple of months, maybe 6 months, and then things will just kind of get a little bit more flexible and a little bit more routine. Because in the reality, Russia just can't eliminate migrant workers. I mean, it would just be shooting itself in the foot.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.